and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shang, and we are here today on this fine, extremely hot Thursday afternoon. It's summer has finally come to Western Washington. I'm so happy. I might even go swimming tonight. You just never even know. Well, we're here today, and it's just me today. Thought I might take another Thursday. I had begun a conversation last Thursday in which we talked a little bit about our obligations as citizens and how we look at them, how we approach things like voting. And I wanted to circle back to that a little bit and then move on a little bit and talk about what we can do, particularly as people who care about the church's teaching about protection of human life from conception to natural death, and how we approach that in the context of the church's whole teaching. Last week, I talked a little bit about the problem that the hole, if you will, that much of the pro-life movement has gotten itself into. The evidence of that hole is the fact that we are stuck with a man like Donald Trump, and are trying our best to figure out what to do with him. And the reality is that Trump is not. Come on, he's not pro-life. We know that. Everybody knows that. This is somebody who took five positions on abortion in the space of 3 days back in April, which is, by the way, the last time you heard about it. And at the conclusion of taking five different positions on abortion, just to sort of keep his finger in the wind and see what would work, he essentially came down to saying that the laws are set, he said, and I don't think we should change them. In other words, don't do anything about Roe v. Wade. And that makes him functionally basically the same as Hillary Clinton. There is one concern that is, I think, worthy of consideration, and that is that Clinton has talked about wanting to overturn the Hyde Amendment and federally funding abortion and so forth. One of the things that's important, we'll talk about this in a minute, it's important to recognize is Democrats also lie to their base, just the way Republican candidates do. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But effectively, when you're looking at somebody like Trump, you're looking at somebody who simply doesn't care about abortion, except insofar, of course, as he can exploit it in order to draw a pro-life vote. How important does he regard the pro-life vote? Not very, because he knows that pro-lifers are in the bag. They'll vote for a Republican as a general rule, no matter what. So he doesn't have to do anything really to keep them happy, except throw them a plastic bone now and then. You'll notice that at the convention, he didn't even mention abortion. Didn't even come up. It was the first time in, I think, 30 years, more than 30 years, that a Republican candidate hasn't even bothered to pretend to care about abortion at the convention. And so how did we get here? Well, we got here by making ourselves willing tools of a political machine that says, yeah, we'll pretend to care, but you have to pay us back. How do we pay that machine back? Well, we pay that machine back by spending all of our time and energy defending whatever culture of death priorities that machine has. And so the irony of having abortion as the fight against abortion, properly speaking, as your core non-negotiable value is that increasingly you don't spend your time and energy on abortion. what you spend your time and energy doing is fighting the church. So when it came time for the Iraq War, you had two bishops and two popes and all the bishops of the world saying, this is a bad idea. Don't do this. This is going to lead to catastrophe. And instead of listening to the church on this, we fought the church. And pro-life people fought the church harder than practically any demographic. They also fought the church harder, literally harder, than any other demographic in American civil life on the mortal sin of torture. It's great. We support it 100%. And then they spent a decade trying to figure out some way to rationalize the use of torture. What they tended to do was limit the discussion to waterboarding and say, well, waterboarding isn't really torture. So that makes it okay. Well, we hanged Japanese for waterboarding. We court-martialed troops in the past for waterboarding people. It's torture. And that, of course, is not the only form of torture that we used. We used forms of torture that killed people. We froze one guy to death who was innocent. He hadn't done anything. And when he was interviewed about it, former Vice President Dick Cheney said, it didn't happen, or it wasn't torture. When somebody dies, it was torture. He said it was worth it. And this is what pro-life people fought the church for. Pro-life people fight the church on the death penalty. They, you know, every August 6th, we hear from an overwhelming cadre of pro-life people who spend their time talking about why the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was fine. It was great. It was a good thing. Something that the church calls a crime against God and man. But you can always count on there being a significant number of pro-life people out there telling the church she's wrong on this and so on and so forth. And we've seen hostility to refugees. We've seen hostility to a social safety net for poor people, healthcare for poor people, a living wage, and all the rest of it. A huge percentage of people who self-identify as conservative Catholics, you can always find them in the vanguard battling the church on all of these issues. Gun violence is another one. And so my approach to all this is really simple. Just don't do that. Don't fight the church. That's all you have to do. And you'll get, you know, what you get all these side issues that come in. You know, while these are all prudential judgments, that's true. But the key to prudential judgment is prudence. And if there's anything that American conservatives have not demonstrated, and again, Exhibit A, Donald Trump, is prudence. Sure, the death penalty is a prudential judgment. The church says, let's get rid of it. Why fight the church on that? Why, if your core value is abortion, why are you wasting time fighting the church on something that is admittedly a prudential judgment, but the church's judgment on this is sound? What's the problem? Why not just go with what the church says? And so that's how we wound up in this position. And not surprisingly, a lot of people come away with the impression that the unborn are basically human shields for whatever culture of death talking points the church happens, or the right happens to like. And even the unborn are not really safe if they happen to be living in, you know, Hiroshima or Nagasaki or some other place that we want to blow up. My radical suggestion is just stop fighting the church. Just don't do that. You don't, doesn't mean you have to like rush out and start protesting against the death penalty, or, you know, taking up some placard and protesting on behalf of minimum wage or whatever. All it means is you just stop fighting the church. That's all you have to do. Just don't fight it anymore on those issues. And if you do that, wind up with then is a lot of time and energy that's freed up because you're not busy fighting the church anymore. What you're doing now is you're taking care of the thing that you say is the most important thing to you. You're focusing on abortion and euthanasia, you know, gay marriage, the integrity of the family, you know, all of those things that are the non-negotiables. And so that's basically my argument there. So the question then becomes, what do we do after that? How can we start thinking in a different way? Because the pro-life strategy isn't working. And that's the real key. I want it to work. I want there to be less abortions. That's the goal. And so how do we approach that issue then? What's the way we achieve the goal of diminishing abortion? That's the goal. And so I think we're almost up against, we're up against the break, but when we return, we will continue that conversation. So you're listening to Connect the Dots. I'm host Mark Shea, and we'll be back right after.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're looking at our responsibility, our civic responsibility, as we approach this election. By the way, if you like this show or all the rest of the shows that we do, I want to urge you to become a friend of the show. And you can do that by going to breadboxmedia.com. And then clicking on the friend of the show link, put my name in there, give me $10 a month, and you'll get access to private content as well as a nifty copy for the winner of our drawing, a nifty copy of the Catholic Mom's Prayer Companion by my friends Lisa Hendy and Sarah Reinhardt. And so check that out, breadboxmedia.com. And then click on the friend of the show link and put my name in there and make a donation of $10 a month. That's you know, what, a couple of Starbucks, maybe one Starbucks these days. I don't know. So I live, by the way, in the land of Starbucks. The Starbucks number one is just a few miles from my house down there in Pioneer Square or Pike Place Market. So you can go to, it's one of the many religious shrines that you can visit when you come to Seattle. It's Starbucks number one. There's also the cathedral, my parish, the science fiction museum. All these things are important. But anyway, getting back to our discussion of our duty as voters, part of the task, we spoke earlier about prudential judgment. And it's worth knowing what we're talking about when we talk about prudential judgment. The church talks about the four cardinal virtues. So prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. These are also called the natural virtues or the hinge virtues, because on them hinges the supernatural virtues. The supernatural virtues are faith, hope, and love. And the cardinal virtue, the thing about the cardinal virtues is that they're virtues that are understandable or accessible by human reason. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone exhibits them. It doesn't even mean that baptized people who also have are granted the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love, even baptized people don't necessarily manifest prudence, temperance, and fortitude. So you can find, you know, foolish baptized people. I'm one of them. You can find people with no temperance, no sense of justice, no fortitude. But we understand what these things are. If they're properly described to us, a lot of the time we don't understand what prudence is because we have a notion of prudence that isn't what the church means by prudence. So sometimes you'll hear people saying, well, we have to be prudent. And what they mean is we have to be timid. That's not what prudence is. Prudence is not timidity. Prudence is having a clear-eyed understanding of what is so. What's going on? There's a great science fiction fantasy writer named Neil Gaiman who wrote a series of graphic novels called the Sandman series. And he dedicated them to G.K. Chesterton. And I love the way he dedicated them. He dedicated them to G.K. Chesterton, saying to G.K. Chesterton, who knew what was going on. And that is really, really true of Chesterton. Chesterton was a prudent man in the Christian sense of the term. He knew what was going on. He had a clear-eyed understanding of what was going on. And the church very much cultivates this. So with prudence, what you're looking at are two things. You're looking at what is happening, what is so now, and how do you practically and sensibly get and justly get to where you are now to the thing that God wants of us. Because, of course, where we are now, among other things, is a fallen world. And the church insists that we have to start by looking around and saying, okay, it's a good world. God made it, but it's also a fallen world. It's a world in which humans are limited by all kinds of things, by money, by their own blindness, stupidity, by their disordered appetites, and all the rest of it. And so that's the first act of prudence, is just taking a look at the world and seeing as clear-eyed and not through some rose-colored glasses or in conformance with some ideology. And when you do that, one of the things that you have to do when we're looking at trying to order the common good so that human life is respected is you have to begin with this reality in the United States. It's this. 20% of Americans want abortion on demand without apology. Another 20% out at the opposite end of the bell curve, that's where you and I live, want it outlawed. We'd love to see it gone. And 60% of Americans don't like abortion and also have absolutely no intention at all of telling some woman in a crisis pregnancy what she's got to do. And so they don't want to outlaw abortion. They don't want Roe v. Wade to go anywhere. In fact, they don't want to think about it at all, and they wish the whole subject would go away. That is the political reality that we live in the United States. Now, it would be great if that weren't true, but it's the way it is. In the same way, for example, the Christian tradition says, you know, it would be fantastic if we could get rid of war, and we should work to, you know, stop wars from happening, prevent wars from happening, and end them as quickly as possible by just means when they do break out. But the reality is you're not going to get rid of war. That's not going to happen. We've had a commandment, you know, since Moses that said, you shall not kill. Well, you know what? Murder has always been part of the human condition. That doesn't mean that we say, oh, well, it's just always going to be part of the human condition, so don't try to do anything about it. We have laws on the books against murder. And so we recognize that there are flaws in the human reality that are there that we're never going to eliminate, but that doesn't mean you don't work against them. Abortion, tragically, falls into that category. We are not utopians as Catholics. And so here we are in the civilization that doesn't like abortion a lot, but also doesn't want to do a whole lot about it. Now, our two major candidates have to navigate that political reality to win. Ethan, I think your mic is on. And there are two basic strategies that dominate and have dominated for 30 years. Trump knows his audience. Every GOP candidate knows his audience. And so what does he do? Well, he speaks of abortion as little as possible, and only to signal his approval of abortion and support for Planned Parenthood to the mainstream, while lying to us pro-life people that he totally hears them and he's on their side and et cetera, et cetera. And then what do? Well, the mark of a con man isn't that he lies to you. He gets you to lie to yourself. And so what do? Well, we do the heavy lifting of rationalizing our support for him when he has, in fact, made clear that he's not going to change a thing in the law and that he likes Planned Parenthood just fine. He says they do good work. So when he's pressed on it back in April, he whipsaws around because he's trying to please everybody because he, like his constituency, wants abortion to just not, he doesn't want to talk about it. So he makes crazy statements about punishing post-abortive women to please people way out at the end of the bell curve because he's running to please them early in the election cycle. And then when everybody else, including, by the way, most pro-lifers, gasp in horror, he rescinds that quickly. And he tacks back to the center and says, the laws are set, let's not change them, and let's not talk about this anymore, and doesn't. In fact, he doesn't talk about it to the degree that when people press him and ask him, have you ever paid for an abortion for one of your many sexual conquests, he won't answer that question. That also should raise some alarm bells. But that's it. He's tacking back to the center, and he has to do that to fool a crowd of suckers that wants him to lie to them. And that crowd has demonstrated time and again that the most transparent cynic can get their passionate support if he just wears a freshest feet pin, like Dick Cheney, for example. So Clinton, though, on the other hand, also has to please her base. So she signals her passionate support for the other 20% of the people out at the end of the bell curve in the campaign. And then later, what happens in the general election, if she follows typical Democratic strategy, is she'll tack back to the center and tell the mainstream, who, remember, they don't like abortion, but they don't want to ban it either, that she'll keep it safe, legal, and rare. We'll talk about this more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we will be back right after this.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are back. We're talking about our duties as Catholics trying to evaluate prudential judgments, trying to think with the church as we approach our civic duties. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1573 4BREAD 4 1573 For Bread 4. And so anyway, we returned. We looked a little bit at the Republican side of the aisle. Clinton, now we're looking at Clinton. And Clinton's in the same boat. She's got to please her base. But she can't just please her base because she's also going to have to appeal to that other 60% of people who don't like abortion. So that makes them interested in the pro-life message. But they also don't want to do anything about abortion, which makes them open to the left side of the aisle. So she's got to please that 20%, the abortion on demand without apology guys. And so she makes that appeal. But historically, what Democrats have done after they've made that appeal is then once you go to the general election and you're no longer just trying to please the people way out at the end of the bell curve who would crawl over broken glass to vote Democrat, then you have to talk to the people in the middle who are uncomfortable with abortion. They don't like it. And so that's where you get phrases like safe, legal, and rare. That was the carefully calibrated, triangulated, classically Clintonian expression that was used back in the 90s. Safe, legal, and rare. So, you know, safe and legal, that appeals to the we don't want to do anything about it. But rare appeals to the we don't like it either. And by the way, Obama did the same thing. You know, a lot of people forget this because back in 2008, you know, Obama, like all Democrats, ran on a pro-abortion platform and making his appeal to the people out of the 20, you know, the 20% out at the end of the bell curve. He said, when I'm inaugurated the first day I'm inaugurated, I'm going to march right over to the White House after the inauguration ceremony, and I am going to sign into the law the Freedom of Choice Act. And everybody, you know, ran around with their hair on fire in the pro-life movement. This is going to be terrible. He's going to do this terrible thing the day he's inaugurated. And then, like, the moment he was elected, you never heard of the Freedom of Choice Act again. It just vanished. Well, why did it vanish? I mean, he's like the most pro-abortion president ever, right? Well, he certainly has done nothing to overturn Roe, but he not so much. The main thing that we saw was not a Freedom of Choice Act. What we saw was, you know, trying to mandate abortion through Obamacare, but the Freedom of Choice Act vanished, and he's never attempted to overturn Hyde, and you know, all of that sort of thing didn't happen with the most pro-abortion president of all time. And that, remember, we're talking about prudence, looking at what is so, what's going on. Well, what's going on is the reality. And we're seeing this again played out with Trump and Clinton, is that on abortion, basically, Trump and Clinton are identical. Now, Clinton has talked about overturning Hyde. Why? Well, because, of course, she's running for that. She's shoring up that base. Let's see how much she talks about it now that we're into the general election. And the reason it's worth paying attention to that, of course, is that when she's elected. I don't think there's really a whole lot of doubt anymore she's going to be elected. Trump is trailing in the polls everywhere and is not coping with any of that well. So on the assumption that she wins the election, what does she have to do? Well, there's a couple of things in play. One of it is she may, in fact, be going up against a Congress that's going to experience a radical shift. If we keep the Congress that we have now, one of the least politically fruitful things she could possibly do is spend her political capital trying to overturn Hyde. Because, remember, 80% of the American people don't like abortion. And they really don't want to pay for it. I mean, they're like, look, the attitude of the average American, like it or not, is I don't feel comfortable telling a woman in a crisis pregnancy what she's got to do. I don't want to think about it. And so that's the attitude of the vast majority of Americans. Well, they do want to think about it if somebody's going to force them to pay for it. That's a different kettle of fish. And so telling the 80% of American people that don't want to think about abortion that we're not only going to make you think about it, we're going to make you pay for it, is a real losing strategy for somebody like Hillary Clinton, who's already entering office as probably she's going to have one of the shortest honeymoon periods in history, because even her own party doesn't like her all that well. And so these are the kinds of things that are worth thinking about. Now, if the GOP loses the Congress, which it's quite possible that they will do, because Trump has a kind of a radioactive death zone around him. And as his numbers plummet, the numbers of the rest of the GOP have also been plummeting. And so there are a number of places where it's a real possibility that the Democrats might wind up with a majority in Congress, which is unusual. Typically, when you have a president who's a member of one party, you tend to get a Congress who's a member of the other party. So that demonstrates something about how popular Congress has made itself. So if that happens, then yeah, it's a possibility that she might really try to overturn Hyde, because she'll have a Democratic Congress behind her. And that is a calculation that has to be weighed in thinking about these things. But if she winds up with a Republican Congress, she's going to face exactly what Obama has faced, which is just wall-to-wall intransigence about everything. A Congress who, you know, if Obama says the sky is blue, they filibuster and say, no, it's brown. And, you know, in some parts of the country, that might be true. But at any rate, what she's got to do, just like what Trump has to do, is tack toward the center. And so what's the practical result? Well, for us as pro-life people, what historically tends to be the result is not that the Republican candidate dances to our tune. We keep hoping that that's going to happen, and it never does. Instead, we dance to his tune. And so what's going to happen? Well, what we're already seeing happen. Pro-life Trump supporters who spend the campaign, and God forbid, the next 4 years, bending over backwards to defend not the unborn, but every stupid thing that Trump says or cares about. And so we've watched this. We've watched as pro-life conservatives have tried to defend the indefensible, tried to defend insults heaped on the grieving family of a guy who died for his country. What? You know, why are we wasting time trying to defend that? Why are we defending it when Trump suggests that maybe gun rights advocates should shoot Hillary Clinton or shoot her Supreme Court nominees? That is, in fact, what was being suggested. And we see this constantly with Trump. Trump says unbelievable things and does unbelievable things. And the energy that should go toward defending the unborn goes toward defending Donald Trump. So we've gotten, you know, defenses and excuses for denials of, you know, his calls for torture. Unfortunately, people who describe themselves as pro-life and conservative and Christian still support torture more than the average American. That's not me. That's a Pew Research poll. And, you know, we've seen defenses of his or excuses for his calls to murder civilians and all the rest of it. And the inevitable result of that dynamic is that pro-lifers are going to get nothing from this guy. If there was ever a candidate who was telegraphing, I don't care about you and you'll get nothing from me, it's pro-lifers who endorse him with a willingness to make war on the church's teaching on a dozen fronts, all while constantly using the unborn as human shields for that. And so you get this rhetoric. I've heard it myself. Well, abortion is the real torture. Why do we care about the torture of a few foreigners and et cetera, et cetera? Who cares about money? You know, abortion is the real issue, not a living wage and et cetera. Well, we will continue this discussion when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back right after this.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. So, we've been talking about taking a prudential assessment of what's going on. And what it comes down to is this. Given all the demographic realities we've just discussed, the actual fact, like it or not, is that Roe is, at least in the foreseeable future, and I think for a good long time beyond that, Roe is not going to be overturned. It's just not. Neither party wants to do it, backed by roughly 80% of Americans. So here's the thing. The whole argument, we got to vote for Trump because of the Supreme Court, is largely a waste of time, because no matter who's in that court, Roe's not going to go anywhere. And in fact, what we discover is if you actually look at the history of abortion jurisprudence in the United States, it's largely a Republican creation. Roe v. Wade was written by Harry Blackmun, who was a Nixon appointee. You had people, Anthony Kennedy, another Republican appointee, is the guy that gave us Casey. We've seen this happened repeatedly. You know, we got to vote for Bush because Supreme Court. And so he gives us John Roberts, who says that Roe is settled law. And that's, I think, just the reality. And so step back for a minute just from the question, what are we trying to say when we're saying that Roe should be overturned? Well, what we're really saying ultimately is Roe would just kick the whole issue back to the states. And the whole thing about the approach that we're taking here is we're focusing entirely on the question of supply of abortion. So what Roe did was that it made a supply of abortion available nationally. It had already become available in some states, my own state, regrettably, in 1970, 3 years before Roe v. Wade had already approved abortion. What Roe did was make it take abortion laws off the books nationally. And all of that is directed toward supply of abortion for people that want abortion. And our whole politics has depended on a supply-demand argument and two parties who manipulate their bases in terms of supply. So Republicans have lied to pro-life people for 30 years that real soon now we will completely outlaw supply. And using that carrot, they have taught pro-life people to battle with might and main to increasingly devote their energies not to this increasingly quixotic goal of outlawing abortion, but to fighting the church on all the GOP's real policy goals, which have been including unjust war, torture, enriching the gun lobby, defending polluters against Laudato Si, the death penalty, grinding the faces of the poor, striving to defend the 1%, and an increasingly xenophobic, and frankly, now with Trump, racist approach to American life. And so those who get all of their news from Fox, talk radio, that sort of thing, see Rush Limbaugh and those guys as their great catechists, have wound up running after Trump. And regard Pope Francis and the Magisterium, which, by the way, would be a really great band name, I think, as very often as the real menace to the church. Because they've completely bought this notion that everything except the five non-negotiables is liberal, and in some cases it's Marxist. And when really what we're talking about is the church's teaching, we're not talking about Marxism, we're not talking about liberalism. And that's how we've come to witness major pro-life figures lining up to back a thrice married draft dodger whose college years of serial fornication were his, quote, personal Vietnam, unquote, an ardent Planned Parenthood supporter who calls for torture and murder of civilians, a fiscal fantasist, four-time bankruptor of businesses, what do Trump businesses do? Well, in many cases, they just do nothing but take your money, and he's still gone bankrupt. This is a man who mocks the disabled and POWs. This is somebody who once took vengeance on his infant nephew with cerebral palsy in a spat over daddy's money. And that is now what the pro-life movement is standing for and defending and telling. And I've been told many and many a time that if I don't vote for him, you know, I'm in rebellion against God, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, what must be done is that this now thoroughly discrediting ideology of the what I call an anti-abortion but not pro-life movement. There is a real pro-life movement out there that is completely pro-life, that embraces the dignity of human life from conception to natural death. But a lot of what calls itself the pro-life movement is really just kind of become an arm of this quixotic fantasy that somehow we're going to overturn Rome. Well, what I suggest is, instead of asking how will this benefit the GOP, we have to ask how can we consistently support the dignity of human life from conception to natural death? Instead of focusing solely on cutting off supply, though that remains important, we have to ask what are we doing to reduce demand? And the moment you do that, you start seeing the shell game that the GOP plays in using the unborn as human shields for policies that, in fact, only guarantee more abortions. So when you pit the unborn against the rest of the church's teaching, that's how we got turned into these stooges for that. My suggestion is come away from all that. Just wash ourselves clean of that whole lie. Adopt a consistent life ethic of respect for human life from conception to natural death. Don't feel bad about your opposition to abortion when lefties yell at you, but also don't feel bad about your support for a living wage. This is the church's teaching that goes back to Rerum Novarum. Don't feel bad about speaking of healthcare as a right, because the church does. Don't feel bad about supporting the church's call to abolish the death penalty. Is it a prudential judgment? Yeah, so what? That doesn't make it false. And in fact, it's a prudential judgment because it's the prudent thing to do. Don't feel bad about, you know, opposition to the next just war when it comes. Don't feel bad when somebody tells you that we need to be torturing those terrorists to, you know, save ourselves from the ticking time bomb somewhere. Ticking time bomb scenarios aren't real. They're action movie fictions. They're not real. Don't feel bad about any of that. Go ahead, support a state social safety net for the poor. The church encourages that and says that it's a good idea. You'll hear, by the way, sometimes people who will say a state social safety net takes away from us our power to be personally charitable. Rubbish. You can be as charitable as you like. We're talking about, you know, taking a few bucks out of your paycheck so that poor families don't have to make a choice between going bankrupt and watching their daughter die of leukemia. And if your primary concern is not that the daughter be treated for leukemia, but who gets the credit for helping that family, then you're not really talking about Christian charity. You're talking about a kind of narcissism. It shouldn't matter who gets the credit as long as the family is helped. The goal is helping the family. And so that whole notion that a state social safety net is somehow robbing me of my power to be charitable is just not true. All it's really doing is helping to make sure that people have the help that they need when they need it. I have a friend who lives in Australia. They have, state insured healthcare. His son was born with Down syndrome and was on the verge of death a number of times. And if it had been here in the United States, he would be in debt for millions of dollars. Well, in Australia, he didn't have to worry about it at all. And guess what? He hasn't become a parasite or a heroin addict or all the rest of it. So we need to, think with the church. What has been proven most effective in combating abortion is not the supply-side fantasy of abolishing Roe real soon now, but rather reducing demand by the liberal, that is to say Catholic, policies of reducing economic pressure on the poor to abort, which the right has taught pro-lifers to battle constantly with these libertarian lies about how it will create a dependent class and et cetera, et cetera. The irony of our time is that it is under the great enemy Obama that abortion rates have dropped to their lowest since Roe. This was supposed to be the end of the world, and abortion rates were going to skyrocket. Why have they dropped? Because the economy improved. And that's the number one abortifacient in the United States is poverty. People don't get abortions for fun. They get abortions because they're desperate. We have to start looking not merely at supply, but at demand. That's the prudent way to approach this as we live out our Catholic lives in this American civilization. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was Ethan Bolin. I will be back tomorrow with Stephen Cardonas. And until then, ta-ta.